came to realize that what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made disaster.
We cannot control the natural disaster, but what we can do is control our response.
Have you ever wondered whether disasters are actually natural? If so, you're in the right place.
Hello and welcome. My name is Jason von Medding.
And I am Ksenia Chmutina.
This is Disasters Deconstructed, a podcast where we examine why disasters really happen.
Thank you for tuning in.
I used to like listening to rain, and now I can't stand it. Yeah. It's so scary.
Yeah.
Like I said before, little things, like if I see a puddle building up, I'm like, shit, is that going to be a flood?
Yeah.
I'm constantly on high alert with it, and it's, I think it's changed me as a person.
Yeah.
But the build up to it, it's palpitations.
Yeah. You can only talk about what you've experienced. I go over that bridge every Tuesday.
Yeah.
So obviously I can see that river, I see it every Tuesday.
But I've got the Environment Agency app on my phone in my favourites for the river levels.
Yeah.
And that starts me off with the anxiety.
Yeah.
It says, oh, Grandma, so sometimes now when it rains really heavy, we're not going to flood, are we, Grandma? We're not going to flood us. Because you panic.
Yeah.
And I say, well, I hope not. Yeah. And all you can say is, I hope not. But every time it rains, so unsure that it would happen again.
It definitely affects you psychologically, there's no question.
Yeah.
Once it flooded, every time it was a lot of rain, probably me more than you, I'd say, oh shit, you know.
But it's scary. But it does affect how you perceive things. I watch the weather like a hawk, and there's some kind of weather warning somewhere.
Yes, I know. And part of it is to do with flooding and the impacts of flooding.
It is.
I'd spent money on this gorgeous sofa, this nice TV, and it were like, are they going to be ruined within 5 minutes?
Fish are more important than my house.
Hi, I'm Dave Angel, and I'm a doctoral researcher at Loughborough University. Welcome back to the second instalment of this series of podcasts, courtesy of Disasters Deconstructed by Ksenia and Jason. In this next instalment, I'll be talking in a bit more detail about my research into flooding in the UK, its effect on home, and how we can investigate this, and examine how people describe their experiences. What are the most important things? How do they cope with flooding? And how does this fit into the bigger cultural and socio-political framework? What are the intersecting forces? And which are the ones that people really think about? If you heard the previous episode, you'll realise that my research aims to represent findings in a somewhat novel way, through the use of audio and sound, rather than just through text or numbers. I've tried to fit quite a lot of different things into this episode. There are plenty of audio examples, but I'll also be having a wider look at the research, talking to some of the stakeholders I've worked with, people who are really at the sharp end of flooding, and whose stories form the basis of the work. In addition, I'll take a deeper look at arts-based research on its subcategories. Then I'll look at how audio can be manipulated and crafted to generate effect by engaging the listener and encouraging them to think below the surface of what they're hearing. First off, here's a few minutes of an interview I did with Jim McLaughlin. Jim works for a local charity providing books to organisations such as schools. It's a great project, and the charity is based in Marshgate in Doncaster, UK, right next to Bentley, where I did most of my interviews, just across the river. Not only did the charity flood during the heavy rain of 2019, but also several of Jim's employees lived very close by and had their homes flooded as well. These people were generous enough to let me interview them afterwards. So just to set the scene, here's the background story from Jim's perspective. Like Jane, the counsellor in the previous episode, it soon becomes apparent that he's another selfless person within the community who always puts others before him.
It was the beginning of November 2019, and I woke up and my phone was ringing. There were three people who were working. Sometime around seven, I got a phone call, and the bank had burst across the road, and it basically filled up with water. It started to kind of fill up outside. So there was a bit of water on the floor. But as they kept talking to me, it seemed to be rising quite quickly. It was a really naive thing because it was, you know, like, we didn't have any sandbags. And I just thought, well, if we just put loads of books there or, you know, like, just to stop the water going in. You know, the situation here got worse. The picture they were painting was one of kind of quite a scary thing. The water was actually forcing up, so it was like a fountain that was flying up into the kitchen. And one of them was saying he was stood on a chair on those scales because the water was coming up so high. You could see that. You know, the whole bowl of Marshgate was full of water. It sounds really silly, but I phoned the emergency services up and I said, I need a boat. to rescue people. And I remember, you know, the thing is, the only thought I had was getting those people out safely. There was nothing about any kind of personal or important things that might be here and destroyed. It was the first thing was getting those people out.
I think you'll agree that that's quite a powerful story about the first day of the floods in 2019. Sadly, it's quite a common occurrence now in many countries. I actually spoke to Jim just over the new year, and he was outside watching the river levels as they rose to within just a few inches of the top of the bank. That was a fairly unedited interview, just with a bit of ambient music. Later on, we'll listen to some more heavily edited examples, with much more fragmented vocal excerpts that leave much more up to the imagination. I'll talk a little bit now about arts-based research, or ABR it's sometimes called. It's an umbrella term, really. Like many academic labels, it can often be a bit vague, and its definition can be quite contentious. Generally speaking, arts-based research can encompass many methods and approaches. They may all have subtle differences, but all will contain some kind of creative activity, either by the researcher or by the researcher and the participants. So the differences are often to do with levels or types of participation. Are people involved in the creative process and how? Or is the real creative input coming just from the researcher or the research team? I consider my approach closest to arts-based knowledge translation, where the researcher aims to convey their findings through an artistic medium, music or sound in this case. Creative Analytic Practice, or CAP, is also another term that might cover it. One principal tenet of arts-based knowledge translation is that the output from any research should have an optimal effect in terms of developing empathy within the listener and also offering practical tools that may have future use within the field. This approach is quite commonly found in health research, but less so in other disciplines at the moment. Of course, there are many different art forms you can choose from. Again, this is down to circumstance, methodology, the purpose of the research, and of course, the researcher's interests and skills. Interestingly, music and audio are used fairly infrequently compared to other art forms, such as poetry, video, dance, drama, and so on. I'm not really certain why this is, because I see music as an equally expressive form. Admittedly, one which is open to wide interpretation, particularly when compared to word-based mediums. Context and subjectivity are so important. I'm an instrumental composer and not a songwriter as such, so I wanted to include words and original voices from the interviews along with the music. It's a happy medium, really. There's still enough room for subjectivity, but there's enough context in the work to maintain some kind of focus within the listener.
Only talk about what you've experienced.
One of the main issues when trying to combine music with spoken excerpts is how far do you go with the music in terms of its foreground or background presence? Is it just underscoring the spoken word, or are we aiming for something more? It's a serious subject, so does it have to be in a minor key? Probably not. But at the same time, you have to be sympathetic and not provide something that sounds sort of jokey. Here's a few very short examples, using the same spoken word phrase, but treated in a different way musically. You can make your own mind up about which are effective and which are too much, or perhaps which ones sound too flippant.
I think it depends on you yourself, how strong you are and what sort of a person you are. But if it happened tomorrow, I'd live through it all again.
once you know it's going to happen, it's a case of, right, okay, mindset, it's going to happen, let's get cracking.
People were brilliant with us. They really were. I think it depends on you yourself, how strong you are and what sort of a person you are. But yeah, if it happened tomorrow, I'd live through it all again.
Once you know it's going to happen, it's a case of, right, okay, mindset, it's going to happen, let's get cracking.
I'm sure you'll agree there that the music can either enhance or diminish what's being said. What I found fascinating in the research is that very early on, Ksenia said to me, the quantity of data was less important than what you actually did with it. And what's jumped out is how much meaning seems to be contained in so few words. Like the phrase,
fish are more important than my house.
It really stuck in my mind at the first interview, and I don't think it would have had the same effect had I just transcribed it and analysed it from there. It could mean so many things and probably means something different to every listener. To me, it conjures up connections, the environment agency, politicians, local politics, national politics, government policy, people's perceived lack of power.
He was sat there and he was taking all notes and everything, and taking it all back to Parliament and one thing and another, you know, like they do.
This seems to conjure up images of decisions being made in the corridors of Parliament or local government. How can people influence these, or how are they influenced by them? So it was really a series of minimal phrases, very short phrases, that seemed to contain so much sentiment and meaning. The idea from presenting it in a musical form, really, or an audio form, is that the listener may draw the connections. Obviously, this depends on foreknowledge and context and opinion and so on. But the idea is to stimulate thought, understanding and empathy.
Here was where the water started building. And literally, hour by hour, I watched it come further and further into my house. Things I've actually ever witnessed. Because I live on my own, so there's not, there weren't anybody that I could sort of go to. It was just frustrating, you can't really do anything. But it's like I say, at the front, I would just, you know, there were all this water, but I could go and stand in the back garden and have a fag. You know, it was just like, what the hell is going on?
Control over one's fate often comes through in the literature as a key feature of a sense of home. And I think that piece sums it up quite well in very few words. Sarah was a really articulate interviewee, and I learnt a lesson in that interview because she was a bit nervous when we started and insisted on starting the interview by drawing a diagram of her house, where it was and where the water came in. I slipped up, actually, and should have kept a copy of the diagram. I'm sure she wouldn't have minded. But that's another lesson learned. It's also a lesson as to how you might start an interview if somebody is obviously nervous. So the aim is to develop new perspectives on home, deeper understanding, and getting a sense of what's important to people and what they really think about when they've been flooded. The aim is also to gain the listener's attention. It's a communicative tool using new media. some of the key features of Home that have come out are all based around this idea of control, privacy, inside, outside. Here's a final piece that sums up how people are attached to their properties and how they don't want to leave them. The last episode will be an extended soundscape featuring some of the materials that you've heard before, but treated in new ways. Thanks for listening.
When I leave here, it'll be on my way where, and I'm not coming back.
There can be no mistaking the seriousness of the situation tonight. Firefighters from as far away as Berwick-upon-Tweed and the West Midlands have been drafted in to respond to this major flooding incident. Lives could be at risk here.
I lived in one room for 18 months.
Lives could be at risk here.
18 months. But I won't move from this area. I won't leave my property. No. For 18 months. No. We just lived upstairs. But no, I won't leave it now.
Yeah.
I lived in one room for 18 months. This is how we are when it floods. This is everything's. The fireplace was in the bathroom.
Lives could be at risk here. Please
don't cry. 18 months.
Lives could be at risk here.
18 months. I lived in one room. Kitchens were ripped out, so they had to live upstairs. But I won't move from this area. I won't leave my property. No. They had to live upstairs. No.
Well, thank you all for being with us today. And before you go, a few quick reminders about how you can stay connected with the podcast.
You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at DisastersDecon.
The podcast is available on all the major platforms. Please download, share, and most importantly, subscribe.
And if you haven't already done this, we really appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts. This will help us to continue making content for you.
You've been listening to Disasters Deconstructed. And don't forget, disasters are not natural. See you next time.